This is session 20. Okay, we're getting down to it, guys. I think three more sessions could possibly... Although, see this? I don't know we're getting through this tonight. So we may have to continue next week. I tell you what, I went through this stuff again, and there was just so much wonderful stuff. I was just trying to cull it down, so we'll see how far we get. But we're going to be talking about extra-canonical literature tonight, and this is one of my favorite areas. It's just so much fun. The stuff that is out there that you've never heard of before, I will guarantee some of the stuff you didn't even know existed, and it's fascinating. What it does is that it sheds a lot of light on what life was like, what was going on in the minds and the hearts of the people in the first century times, in the times that, in which the canonical literature was being written, because all this stuff was being written contemporaneously and then afterward. And it's fascinating to me, because what it shows is, it shows human beings doing what human beings do. If you think about it, you know, after the events, whatever events happen in either our lives personally or the lives of our country or the lives within our culture, the same thing takes place. The first thing is, we're all talking about it, right? Something happens either in our families or something as catastrophic as 9/11 or anything that happens to us that we know about. Everybody's talking about it. At the same time, records are being kept and people start writing things down. And so you got reporters, and they're making notes, and they're taking, and then eventually that stuff is compiled into what? News reports, maybe TV documentaries in our time. Eventually the books start coming out, right? And they'll come out later. And then eventually books about the books and commentaries and retrospectives. And then people will go back into the lives of the people that were the players in this. So, you know, we even have biographies of some of the people that were affected in say 9/11, you know. So now we hear biographies about the firemen or about their families, people who survived, people who didn't. And this is the same thing that was going on in the first century. If you think about it, you had this seminal event, this huge event in the life of Jesus Christ, taking place in people's lives, and everybody's buzzing, everybody's talking about it. While he's alive, of course, leading up to the crucifixion, after the crucifixion, and that buzz continues at the same time that people are keeping records of what Jesus said. That would have been the first thing that they would have written down. What did he say? And so there are sayings, gospels, and there are records about things that he did, the signs and the wonders and the miracles and the healings and all these things. These are being kept contemporaneously with Jesus' life and shortly thereafter. And then you come with the letters of Paul, and then they're compiled into Gospels, and the first Gospels are sayings Gospels with no narrative. Then the narrative is added. Then the birth narratives. What about Jesus when he was born? How was he born? And what was the story there? And so everything is filled in over time. But that's not even enough, because you move out another generation or two, and people become more curious about, well, what was he like as a child? You know, now we understand him as the Son of God, but what was he like growing up? What was it like to raise him? And so these infancy narratives start being written. It's a fascinating look just at the human nature playing itself out in the record of all of this literature. And so if you look here, we've got this period of Old Testament composition. Anywhere between 2000 and 1400 BCE to 400 BCE, the supposed time of silence between the Testaments, New Testament composition 50 CE to maybe 100 CE. These are really relative dates, and they move all over the place depending on the scholar. But in this period of silence, that begins when the Jews return back from Babylon, the time of captivity. They are devastated as a nation. You know, they come back to basically a smoking crater, and they have to find a way to rebuild their lives. The literature that's being written here now, under the yoke of the Babylonians, and then the Persians, and then the Greeks, and then the Romans, during this whole period of time, is generally apocalyptic in nature and messianic in nature. What does that mean? Apocalyptic literature like Daniel, like Ezekiel, like Revelation in a later period, it's prophetic in its tone, but what it's really trying to do is encourage the people through this time of national catastrophe. when you come back to a smoking crater, when everything that you know is gone, how do you persevere in your faith? How do you still know that God is on his throne and that everything will be all right? These books are trying to bridge that gap, to take the people through and give them hope that even though everything is gone, things are as bad as they can be, there is still going to be a time where you can't see how it possibly can happen, but that God is going to intervene. God is going to step back in and make things right. You know, things will be equalized. Justice will be served. And if you think about Revelation, which may be the book, apocalyptic book that you're most familiar with, and you have all these horrible, violent images, but at the end, what happens? God intervenes, and in no human way possible that you could imagine, things are made right again. And you see the same sort of visions taking place in Daniel and Ezekiel. And now you've got all these extra canonical books, like the Book of Enoch, which we're going to read a little bit from, hopefully tonight or next week if we don't get to it, and other books that are apocryphal in nature. That is coming from the Jewish tradition. Okay, and then you've got the period of New Testament composition. Books are being written that get into the canon. Books are being written that don't get into the canon. And then after the period of the canonical books being finished around the end of the first century, books are still being written, you know, and are still being written today. But these are the books that we want to take a look at in this period as much as possible. Some of the New Testament extra canonical books we'll be looking at are going to date, you know, through the second century and maybe into the first part of the third. But we're not going to go much further than that because we want to take a look at books that are pretty close to the source events. But you're going to see as we read them, read through them, this whole thing in process. So here on this first page is a list of the different categories of extra-canonical books that we're talking about. Does anyone have a problem when I say extra-canonical? Everyone knows what I'm talking about? Okay, outside the canon of Scripture. So in the Protestant tradition, 66 books of the Bible, Old Testament, New Testament, anything outside of those 66 books we call extra-canonical. It's outside the canon, all right? I'm sorry? Canon actually comes from a word that originally meant a measuring rod or a stick. So it was the standard by which all these books had to measure up in order to be considered inspired by God. Authoritative, inerrant, all the things that we understand of the books of the Bible. So the apocrypha means hidden. Yeah. So apocryphal in this context means books that are not part of the canon and are considered hidden away, but they're not part of the actual canon of the Scriptures as we understand them. Okay. So apocryphal books, these are canonical Old Testament books, not existent in the Hebrew manuscript, only in the Septuagint. And to answer a question that maybe you haven't asked yet, but it'll be there shortly, they're canonical in 2/3 of Christianity, in the Roman tradition, Catholic tradition, and also in the Eastern Orthodox tradition, but not in the Protestant. The Protestant at the time of the Reformation threw those books out because they didn't exist in the Hebrew manuscripts. So for Protestants, we got 66 books. Catholics have 72. Eastern Orthodox have anywhere from 76 to 79, depending on how the books are broken up. Okay, so they're canonical for some, non-canonical for others. They are non-canonical to the Jews today, canonical for 2/3 of Christianity. Then you've got a Christian apocrypha. These are non-canonical books that are written in the Christian tradition. And so we're going to be reading through some of those. You have Jewish pseudepigrapha, another word that means false writings. All that really means, though, is that they can't be ascribed to the writers to whom they are purported to have been written by. So, for instance, the Book of Enoch was not written by Enoch, and it wasn't written anywhere close to the time of Enoch, which would have been the time of the patriarchs. It was probably written in the 1st or 2nd century B.C., okay, in that intertestament time of quote-unquote silence. Then you've got Gnostic scriptures. The Gnostics were a Christian sect that had taken the religion into a mystery tradition. And we're going to be reading a lot of Gnostic scriptures. They're non-canonical, they're Gnostic, and the main find at Nag Hammadi in Egypt was a treasure trove of some of these books, whereas many of them did not exist at all, except in the writings against them. the early church fathers in the first few centuries of the church wrote against these books and quoted from them in their writings. So those were the only fragments that we had from these books until these jars were unearthed and gave us, you know, actual extant copies. Dead Sea Scrolls, you're all familiar probably with those. Some are canonical, some are non-canonical, but they're all Jewish. No books from the New Testament, Old Testament only, and then lots of books outside of the Old Testament. The canonical texts as well. We've got the Kabbalah mostly from more medieval times, but the Kabbalah is non-canonical Jewish mystical texts. We're not going to be reading from any of those. They're a little bit late for us. And then you have authoritative Jewish writings, the Midrash, the Talmud, and the Tosefta, which were added to Jewish tradition, especially it was oral tradition in the time of Jesus. And then after the fall of the temple, they were written down. And let's turn the page and let's take a look at those just so you're familiar with some of the components of that. What I'm trying to do is just give you an overview of all the materials, and then we're going to start to read through some of them. So basically what you have in the Jewish tradition, we talked about their Bible, which is divided into three parts, the Torah, the Nevi'im, and the Ketuvim, which is the law, the writings, and the prophets. The rabbis were constantly commentating on these books, writing about them, doing commentaries. They were doing interpretations of the law. The law interpretations, what was called the Haggadah, or the way of walking, the way of living, was an oral tradition that had grown to thousands of rules that were wrapped around the 613 written laws of the Torah. And these were the rules that Jesus was basically sparring with the Pharisees about, you know, because they had put so many laws on top of the laws that they literally subverted the intent of the law in the first place. And so this is what Jesus was trying to get through to the people, is that it's not about following all these rules. It's about changing your heart so that you fulfill the intent of the law. Go ahead.
Is all that extra Jewish writing on the law? Is that the stuff in the Bible? Any of that in the Bible?
No. Well, they considered there to be 613 laws that were part of the written Torah. Okay? And they have beyond just the Ten Commandments, there's lots of other rules and regulations that needed to be pulled out. But you could look at the text and you could say, okay, this is another law, this is another law. So they came up with 613 divided into negative and positive rules, things that you couldn't do, things that you needed to do. Okay. But beyond that, they had all these oral traditions. They called them hedges or fences around each law. So, for instance, the Sabbath law had 39 categories of other laws around it so that you wouldn't violate the Sabbath. The idea was you had to violate all these before you got to actually break a law. But each one of those 39 were categories. So they had categories and subcategories under that. So there are literally dozens and dozens of rules, hedges and fences around the written law, which was just keep holy the Sabbath and don't do any servile work. But then, of course, the legal mind says, what's servile work? What can I do? What can't I do? And so they came up with lots of rules. You know, the only thing that the written rule says is you can't light a fire. All right. Well, can I keep a fire burning from yesterday and use it? You know, what if the fire goes out? Can I just drop something on it and then it burst back? You know, see, all of these questions, it's just like our Constitution, you know, short document, but now 235 years later, there's millions of lines of code because lawyers and judges have interpreted and written rules and all these decisions about the law. Same thing's happening in Judaism. So by the time you get to Jesus' day, there are literally these millions of lines of code. That may be an exaggeration. Certainly thousands of lines of code. And the people were burdened by this. Right? After the fall of the temple in 70 CE, Judaism had to be reinvented because there was no longer a temple, no longer a sacrificial system, no longer any government of any kind. The city was gone. It was leveled. And so what they did was take all of those rules and wrote them down. And that's basically what the Mishnah is. The Mishnah is the codification, the writing down of all of those oral traditions, rules, and regulations. They finally wrote it all down. Now, there were two main Jewish communities, one in Palestine, the one we're familiar with, but also the remnant that stayed behind in Babylon. So there are two Talmuds, One is the Babylonian Talmud, and the other is the Palestinian Talmud. So there's two of them with those two different traditions. But they have basically the same components to them. And so as you look at these authoritative Jewish writings, actually down the side there, that in my handwriting, the Torah is the written law. That's the primary source. The writings, or the hagiographa, the holy writings, are the secondary source. The Kabbalah are the traditions. The Midrash are the interpretations. Those will be the commentaries on the scripture. The Mishnah, the repetition, doubling, or explanation is what Mishnah means, is the explanation of scripture, a compilation of Midrash and the oral laws. So Jewish literature then is divided in that oval there into two sides, the Halakha, which is the way of life, and the Haggadah, which is the narrative, and then the Jewish writings, those four circles in the box, are all the various pieces that make up this other tradition of non-canonical Jewish writing, but they're authoritative within Judaism. These laws, these books carry weight, the authority. And in many cases, in fact, the Talmud states that the writings in the Talmud can supersede the actual scriptures of the Tanakh, the Jewish canonical scriptures.
The Torah is part of the Bible, right?
Absolutely. Torah is the first five books.
That's the only one in these, on this list right here that's part of the Bible?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So, I'm not going to test you on this or anything. I just wanted to just get you an overview. When people talk about the Talmud, you know, if you hear that word, what they're talking about are these writings. These all stem from starting around, you know, 70 to 90, 80 AD, CE, starting in that. But it took a couple of centuries for all this to really fully be compiled in the two traditions. So it took a long time, but it stems from that era, from the end of the first century into the end of the second, start of the third is when all these writings were being taken place. So that's one class of scripture. We're not going to be reading from the Talmud tonight. That will be for another time. What we are going to be reading from a couple of sources, is the Dead Sea Scrolls. So unless there's any questions about the Talmud or the Jewish authoritative writings, let's switch over to the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is just a bunch of interesting points about the scrolls. And we'll just kind of read through some of them. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered in 11 caves along the northwest shore of the Dead Sea between the years 1947 and 1956. The year I was born, by the way. It was a good year. Originally... yeah, 47. Originally discovered by shepherd boy looking for a lost goat. Made of leather, they were originally sold to a sandal maker to be used as sandal leather until someone noticed writing on them. Interesting, huh? It's so funny. So many of these Indiana Jones kind of stories of this, and they really are like Indiana. Wait till you hear the one about Nag Hammadi. I'll read about that as well. People don't know what they've got. You know, it's just people stumbling upon these things. And it's just heartbreaking how much of these precious antiquities have been lost just due to ignorance, not knowing what they've got, and so on and so forth. So made of leather, originally sold to a sandal maker to be used as sandal leather, and so someone noticed writing on them. How good would a shoe be made of 2,000-year-old leather? I don't know. They must have been well-preserved. The cave area is 13 miles east of Jerusalem and is 1,300 feet below sea level. It's one of the lowest spots on Earth. The most fragmented texts are numbered according to the cave that they came out of. They have been called the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times. And so this boy is looking for his goat. He moves in a cave and he finds these large earthen jars. When they're finally opened, inside were big lumps and no one really knew what they were. They pulled them out, and it turns out what they did was they took the scrolls, they wrapped them in linen, and then saturated the linen with wax or tar-like pitch to seal them completely, and then put them inside the jar and then sealed the jar. So with that kind of preparation, at least there was some amount of... And also because of the arid climate, they're in the desert, so there's not a lot of moisture. So they were able to be preserved. Even so, most of the papyrus was pretty well fragmented. But the leather and, of course, the copper scroll, the one that was actually etched into sheets of copper, survived quite well. So it just depended on the materials, once again, how well they were going to survive over that period of time. Only caves 1 and 11 have produced relatively intact manuscripts. Discovered in 52, cave 4 produced the largest find. About 15,000 fragments from more than 500 manuscripts were found. I don't know if they say in here, this is probably a sect of the Essenes that had been living at Qumran for who knows how long, several generations possibly. They were so sick of the corruption as they saw it in Jerusalem and the way that the leaders of the Hasmonean leaders of the civil authorities and the Sadducees who were in charge of the temple were corrupting the whole system. So they exited, and they were trying to preserve a pure form of Judaism that would take over once everybody else was obliterated. So they were going to come back in, reoccupy the land, and be that pure remnant. That was the whole thing that they were about. And they were basically waiting for this to happen. But when the Roman armies marched in during the first Jewish-Roman war, that's when they probably squirreled away all these manuscripts because they could see the writing on the wall and what was going to happen, and to be found 2,000 years later. In all, scholars have identified the remains of about 825 to 870 separate scrolls made of leather or parchment. The scrolls can be divided into two categories, biblical and non-biblical. Fragments of every book of the Hebrew canon, Old Testament, have been discovered except for the Book of Esther. The Book of Esther is also the only book that doesn't mention God in it. Interesting, huh? There are now identified among the scrolls 19 copies of the book Isaiah, 25 copies of Deuteronomy, 30 copies of the Psalms, prophecies by Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and Daniel not found in the Bible are written in these scrolls. So we have some extra canonical prophecies by these prophets. Yeah, Tony. Oh, none whatsoever. The Nag Hammadi Library is a Gnostic library in the Christian tradition, so it's going to have parallels with the New Testament Gospels, but not with anything that was found at the Dead Sea Scrolls. Yeah, but they were found about the same time. In fact, the Nag Hammadi find was slightly before the Dead Sea Scroll find, a couple of years. I think it was 1945.
So the Dead Sea Scrolls have no New Testament.
No New Testament, unless you agree with a few scholars who think a few fragments are connected with New Testament books, but those were so fragmentary that it pretty much is impossible to tell. It's kind of an eye of the beholder thing. A couple of words lined up with New Testament books, but most scholars believe that they were not New Testament. Even so, these scrolls shed a lot of light on the on New Testament times in the first century, and gave clues toward the thought processes about how Jewish the first followers of Jesus were, because they were able to see in the lives of these Essenes and these writings, making parallels to canonical writings and connecting the dots between them. And so we get a lot of insight into this ultra-conservative Jewish sect. These would be the kind of guys, like for us, would be up in the hills of Montana or Idaho with bunkers and weapons and that sort of thing. These were these kind of guys, you know, in Judaism. But also we get to see, we get some light shined on how Jewish these first followers of Jesus were as well. So it shined a lot of light on the New Testament, but there's nothing directly about the New Testament. Let's see, where were you? The Isaiah scroll, number 7, found relatively intact, is 1,000 years older than any previously known copy of Isaiah. In fact, the scrolls are the oldest group of Old Testament manuscripts ever found. In the scrolls are found never-before-seen psalms attributed to King David and Joshua. There are non-biblical writings along the order of commentaries on the Old Testament, paraphrases that expand upon the law, rule books of the community, war conduct, thanksgiving psalms, hymnic compositions, benedictions, liturgical tests, and sapiential, nice word, huh? Wisdom writings. The scrolls are for the most part written in Hebrew, but there are many written in Aramaic. Aramaic was a common language of the Jews of Palestine for the last 2 centuries B.C. and of the first 2 centuries A.D. The discovery of the scrolls has greatly enhanced our knowledge of these two languages. In addition, there are a few texts also written in Greek. Let's see. The scrolls appear to be the library of a Jewish sect. The library was hidden away in caves around the outbreak of the first Jewish revolt as the Roman army advanced against rebel Jews. Number 13, the Dead Sea Scrolls were most likely written by the Essenes during the period from about 200 BC to 68 CEAD. The Essenes are mentioned by Josephus in a few other sources, but not in the New Testament. And we've talked about the rest. 14, the enemies of the Qumran community were called the Sons of Darkness. They called themselves the Sons of Light, the poor, and members of the Way. Interesting, huh? Which is exactly what the first followers of Jesus called themselves. You know, the followers of the Way. Talmidi Orha in Aramaic. They thought of themselves as the Holy Ones who lived in the house of holiness because the Holy Spirit dwelt with them. Kind of echoes of you know... But there was that understanding of this Holy Spirit, or the Spirit of God in Judaism. So you figure if these are occurring over a 300-year period thereabouts, from about 200 BCE to 100 CEAD, that it predates Jesus and is contemporaneous with Jesus. And I'll get to you a sec. And also, some scholars believe that Jesus was an Essene, and that perhaps he came out of one of these communities. And so when you see some of these things, you can see why scholars are believing that may carry some weight, because you see similar concepts and terminology existing in the Qumran texts as well as in the New Testament. And so they're seeing those kind of connections. But there are other scholars that believe that Jesus was a Pharisee and came out of that tradition. So there's reasons for that too. So pick your poison. Yeah, they were even more conservative than the Pharisees, but it was a different take. The Pharisees were working within the community, but they were separating themselves at the same time. I mean, the word Pharisee comes from the Hebrew word to separate, and so they separated themselves from anything that was unholy. The Essenes separated themselves from the culture completely and created their own community. Now, within their community, they dealt justly and well with everybody there. So it's hard to say. Jesus has similarities with both groups, but he clearly, you know, transcended both of them and was his own man and was sparring with the Pharisees over here. And he was certainly completely immersed in his community, unlike the Essenes. So, you know, can we really pigeonhole Jesus that way? Not too much. Bill?
I was just going to say that in the 46th chapter of Ezekiel, there's a crystal clear mention of the Trinity. The Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. I mean, it's just like, wow. You know? 46, I don't know what verse it is. It's in the 46th chapter. The 46th chapter is 290 pages long, so enjoy it. As you go looking for it. I'm just kidding.
Remember that the Essenes call themselves the Sons of Light, because later when we're reading from the Gospel of Thomas, that's going to come up too, and you'll see another possible connection between Jesus and this Qumran community. Number 15, the last words of Joseph, Judah, Levi, Naphtali, and Amram, the father of Moses, which would be the Egyptian father of Moses, are written down in the scrolls. One of the most curious scrolls is a copper scroll discovered in Cave 3. This scroll records a list of 64 underground hiding places throughout the land of Israel. The deposits are to contain certain amounts of gold, silver, aromatics, and manuscripts. They are believed to be treasures from the temple at Jerusalem that were hidden away for safekeeping. And if you don't think that didn't spur some looking, you got another thing coming. Everybody had their hats, their Indiana Jones hats. They're looking. Not that I know of. Not that I know of. I'm sorry? Yeah. Not that I know of that they found anything. But that doesn't mean they're not there. Hope springs eternal. Number 18, the scrolls contain previously unknown stories about biblical figures such as Enoch, Abraham, and Noah. And the story of Abraham includes an explanation why God asked Abraham to sacrifice his only son, Isaac. Very interesting, huh? What's that?
Do we know what that is?
Yeah. You want to know what that is? Actually, it's really fascinating what this story contains, because it's just like Job. Remember when we talked about that? Some scholars believe that the core of Job, the middle chapters, were written at an earlier time, and that the introduction, the prologue, and the epilogue were added later. And the prologue, of course, contained of that scene in heaven, the wager between Satan and God. And it sets up the whole reason why all these terrible things befell Job. And then the end, of course, is the wrap-up. God speaking from the whirlwind and everything being restored to Job at the end. The explanation is very similar. There is a scene in heaven where a figure like Satan, I think he's called Mashtoma or something like that. I can't remember his name, but it means the son of maliciousness or something like that. Anyway, he's an adversarial satanic figure who again comes to God and says that he believes that Abraham will not be able to withstand his testing. And so God allows him to test Abraham in this way, so that the request to kill his son did not come from God. It came from this adversary. And God allowed the testing, you know, for the same reason that God allowed the testing for Job. So that's the reason behind it. Interesting, though, huh? Yeah. Well, you know, it's not canonical, though, you know, but the Job story is. And so, well, someone had to make some choices there. But it is so hard for us to understand why God allows certain things. And again, it's a very human thing. Trying to work through, why would these things happen? Why would God allow these things to happen? Would God initiate such things? It just doesn't make any sense to us in what we believe about God. And so, a community trying to deal with these stories, did they add these things later? Should they be canonical? Should they not? These are all questions that had to be answered by the church authorities at the time. And so one story comes in, the other story stays out. Who knows? But that, anyway, in this particular story, this non-canonical story about Abraham, is the reason why. Let's see, last page. 19. The scrolls are most commonly made of animal skins, but also papyrus and one of copper. They are written with a carbon-based ink from right to left, using no punctuation except for an occasional paragraph indentation. In fact, in some cases, there are not even spaces between the words. That scripta continua we talked about and looked at the copy of, right? Only these are Jewish scrolls. The scrolls have revolutionized textual criticism of the Old Testament. Interestingly, now with manuscripts predating the medieval period, we find these texts in substantial agreement with the Masoretic text, as well as widely variant forms. And this was the miracle that was discovered, you know, to get a copy of the Isaiah scroll, especially 1,000 years older, and find it's pretty much there. No, very, very few changes. Amazing, amazing. So we're going to talk about divine providence. There it is. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls actually appeared for sale on June 1st, 1954 in the Wall Street Journal. The advertisement read, "The four Dead Sea Scrolls, biblical manuscripts dating back to at least 200 BC, are for sale. This would be an ideal gift to an educational or religious institution by an individual or group." Box F206. Nice. Although Qumran community existed during the time of the ministry of Jesus, none of the scrolls refer to him, nor do they mention any of his followers described in the New Testament. The major intact texts from Caves 1 and 11 were published by the late 50s and are now housed in the Shrine of the Book Museum in Jerusalem. Since the late 50s, about 40% of the scrolls, mostly fragments from Cave 4, remained unpublished and were inaccessible. It wasn't until 1991, 44 years after the discovery of the first scroll, after the pressure for publication mounted, that general access was made available to photographs of the scrolls. In November of 1991, the photos were published by the Biblical Archaeological Society in a non-official edition. A computer reconstruction based on a concordance was announced. The Huntington Library pledged to open their microfilm files for all scroll photographs. And the Dead Sea Scrolls enhance our knowledge of both Judaism and Christianity. They represent a non-rabbinic form of Judaism and provide a wealth of comparative material for New Testament scholars, including many important parallels to the Jesus movement. They show Christianity to be rooted in Judaism and have been called the evolutionary link between the two. Don't underestimate the importance when they say that this is a form of non-rabbinical Judaism. Because remember, of those main groups that we talked about, there are four main groups in Judaism before the Roman-Jewish War. And they were the Essenes, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, and the Zealots. The Zealots really aren't part of this because they were pretty much, they were the terrorists of their day. They didn't have so much of a religious base. But the other three represented very different religious takes. But after the temple falls, after the dust clears, after the first Roman-Jewish war, the only ones left standing are the Pharisees, who were the rabbis, and that was that rabbinic tradition. Since they were the only ones left standing, they were the ones who redefined Judaism and reinvented it. And so what we have today and all the scriptures we have come out of that one tradition. So here in a time capsule is a group of scrolls that come from outside that tradition. Very important. It's kind of like the parallel would be in the Christian tradition would be when those Alexandrian textual families were found just in the last 100-150 years that stood outside of that Byzantine family, which was the only family we had going forward from which the King James Bible descends and all of this. And suddenly now we have this family of texts that stands outside that tradition and gives us something to compare to. The Dead Sea, what that did for the New Testament, the Dead Sea Scrolls did for the Old Testament, and it was really important. That gives these scholars some room to move and some more text to look at, and really gave them a lot of insight. Okay, any questions about that? Yeah.
Was it true that those scrolls that went up for sale on Wall Street went for $250,000?
That I don't know. That's what you heard?
That's what I heard. That's an awful lot of money.
Yeah, yeah. Especially back, what year was that, 54? 54, yeah. That's a lot of money in 1954. It's still a deal. What's that? I don't know about that. What I know is that the scrolls, what they said here about it being in Jerusalem at the Biblical Archaeological Site, where was that? Anyway, they're there. So even if they were sold, they may have been sold back. But I know that that is the main repository for the scrolls. If there are any, a few of them that got away and are elsewhere, they just came through San Diego not too long ago, and I really wanted to get down there, and we never made it. That would have been great. Yeah, they packed them up, and they brought them on tour, and they came through North America, and they were down in San Diego for, I don't know, a couple months or something like that. Yeah. Yeah, and we meant to do it, and we just never made it. But that would have been great to... It's just amazing, you think about it. You're standing in the presence of these 2,000-year-olds and that history, and who was the person who wrote these things and touched them and handled them and cared for them, you know? And it's just, I don't know, it's just an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine if we could ever find an autograph and could know that it was an autograph. Would that be cool? Did you have something, Joe? Okay, let's shift gears and let's move from Old Testament extra-canonical literature to New Testament. And there's several categories again, and one of them is called agrapha, and agrapha. Agrapha are words of Jesus that are not recorded in the New Testament, at least not recorded in the Gospels, but are recorded elsewhere, right? And then there are apocryphal books. I'll give you some examples in a second. The apocryphal books, we know about those. And so, see, apocryphal books, first and second Middle Ages, often written in the name of apostles, associates of Jesus, and they mirror the canonical material. We have other gospels, a similar format, sometimes sayings gospels, acts of various players within the New Testament, characters from the New Testament, acts of them. Apocalypses, and the writings of the church fathers. So all of these are in the Christian tradition that are giving us more information. These were never part of the canon, though some of the church father material included canonical collections and so on and so forth. I wanted to focus for a little bit on the Agrapha in the New Testament, and I don't want to actually look these up, but I'll go ahead and tell you the verse and citations. It'll be there for the recording anyway. But to give you a couple examples, in Acts 20:35, Paul says, and he attributes it to Jesus, that it's more blessed to give than to receive. Okay? And that is recorded no place in the Gospels, but Paul attributes it to him. And I think it's at the end of John, right, where he says that, you know, all the libraries in the world, you know, couldn't hold. Kind of reminds me of all the gin joints. She had to walk into mine or something. All right, that was out of left field. I don't know why that just popped into my head. Okay, go home and watch Casablanca if you don't know what that's about, all right? But anyway, obviously there were lots of things that were not recorded in the New Testament about Jesus, and John is alluding to that, you know. So, more blessed to give than to receive. 1 Corinthians 7:10 and 9:14 are Paul's teaching based on Agrapha. So, when Paul says something like, I'm going to tell you something, it's not I who am telling you, but from the Lord. You remember him using that kind of phraseology? So, what he's doing, he's saying, this was a teaching from Jesus, but it's not recorded in the New Testament. He's not saying that. We can't find it anywhere. But then he goes on. And in this first citation at 1 Corinthians 7:10, he's dealing with divorce and remarriage. You know, this is where he's talking about if you have a non-believing spouse and they leave, then go. Actually, I think that part was from him. But the first part, you know, if you're married, stay together and so on and so forth. So he's giving this teaching as from Jesus. He doesn't quote Jesus. He just gives the teaching in a paraphrased way, in his own words. But he attributes it to Jesus. 1 Corinthians 11:24-25, he quotes the words from the Last Supper, but he quotes them in a way that does not parallel any of the gospel accounts. You know, this is my body and, you know, do this in remembrance of me. But he doesn't use the same formulation that appears in the gospels. So that would be another form of Agrapha, which is actually the formulation that the Catholic Church uses in the liturgy in remembrance of me. 1 Thessalonians 4:15-17a, this is an interesting one because, again, he attributes it to a teaching from Jesus. And this is the passage that is used most often as a proof text for the rapture. This is where it'll be gathered and caught up in the clouds. And the actual word caught up is the raptura in Latin, where we get the word rapture from. So that teaching is what he, again, attributes to Jesus, but there's no parallel in the New Testament. So within the New Testament itself, in these letters, we find these allusions to Jesus' words that don't occur in the scriptures called Agrapha. There are also Agrapha and variant readings of the New Testament manuscripts, and I wanted to go through just a couple of those so you can see. Variant readings, we're on page 154 if you do have your textbooks. It is possible that the variant readings of Luke 6:5 found in one codex dated from the 5th to 6th century records a saying of Jesus which states, and here's the quote, "The same day, seeing a certain man working on the Sabbath, he said to him, 'Man, if indeed you know what you are doing, happy are you, but if not, you are accursed and a transgressor of the law.'" When we're talking about variant readings, These are those, remember the all the different manuscripts that we have? They have variant readings. There's changes and differences between them. Some of these differences are agrapha, like in this one, in this particular Codex Bizet. It states a quote from Jesus that we don't find in the other readings. And so the question, of course, becomes, is it authoritative or is it not? Well, if it's only occurring once, then it's not going to be included as authoritative in most scholars' work, which is why you probably haven't heard of that one before. Another edition occurs in the same codex after Matthew 20:28 and may also include a saying of Jesus, and it goes like this, but seek to increase from smallness and from the greater to become less. And when you go in or are invited to dine, do not recline in the prominent place, lest one more illustrious than you come in. And he who invited you to dinner say to you, go even lower down, and you shall be put to shame. But if you recline in the lesser place, and a lesser man come in, he who invited you to dinner will say, come higher up, and this will be profitable to you. So it parallels another saying, but it's stated differently. There's another one after Mark 16:14. And they excuse themselves, saying, this age of lawlessness and unbelief is under Satan, who by his unclean spirits does not allow the true power of God to be comprehended. Therefore, now reveal your righteousness, and so on and so forth. There also is a grapha recorded by the church fathers. And so these various fathers, like Papias and Eusebius, Justin Martyr, Tertullian, Clement of Alexandria, Origen, Jerome, Augustine, all of these also include quotes, and a couple of the interesting ones, let's see. For he, Jesus, said, many shall come in my name, clad outwardly with sheepskins, but within they are ravening wolves. That also parallels something. No man can obtain the kingdom of heaven that hath not passed through temptation. Let's see. I will choose for myself the best which my Father in heaven has given me. So once again, just more examples of sayings of Jesus, you know, I guess from John's library that didn't get in. But interesting that these are all there. There are also more sayings of Jesus, and we're going to read lots of them from these Gnostic texts, from the Nag Hammadi finds. And then if you turn your page, here is a fairly comprehensive listing of New Testament apocryphal texts. It's a long list. And these are the main ones. So you've got Gospels and related forms, narrative Gospels. Look at these Gospels. Did you know there is a Gospel of the Ebionites? Gospel of the Hebrews, Gospel of the Nazareans, Gospel of Nicodemus, or the Acts of Pilate, Gospel of Peter, Infancy Gospel of Thomas, Revelation Dialogues and Discourses, Apocalypse of James, Second Apocalypse of James, Apocryphon of James, Apocryphon of John, Book of Thomas the Contender, Dialogue of the Savior, and so on and so forth. Sayings, Gospels, and Collections, the Gospel of Thomas, the most famous one, and Teachings of Silvanus. Then there's Treatises and the Apocalypses, Apocalypse of Elijah, Peter, Paul, and so on and so forth. Then you have Acts, and over there on the second column, Acts of Andrew and Matthias, John, Paul, Acts of Peter, Philip, Thomas, so on and so forth. You have letters, liturgical materials, homilies, psalms, prayers. All of these are forming that cloud of extra-canonical literature. And all of this is fodder for these scholars. These are the types of books that they're using to compare and contrast and to try to, again, that Holy Grail, searching for the original text, always looking for that. Before we actually get into it, yeah, we're getting pretty late, aren't we? I wanted to read you this one account because this is just too good to let go, of the find at Nag Hammadi, and this is the in Egypt, the find of this Gnostic cache of another jar of text. But listen to this story; it just reads like a B movie or something. In December 1945, an Arab peasant made an astonishing archaeological discovery in Upper Egypt. Rumors obscured the circumstances of this find, perhaps because the discovery was accidental and its sale on the black market illegal. For years, even the identity of the discoverer remained unknown. One rumor held that he was a blood avenger, another that he had made the find near the town of Nag Hammadi at the Jabal al-Tarif, a mountain honeycombed with more than 150 caves. Originally natural, some of these caves were cut and painted and used as grave sites as early as the 6th dynasty, some 4,300 years ago. 30 years later, the discoverer himself, Muhammad Ali, I kid you not, Muhammad Ali al-Samayn, told what happened. Shortly before he and his brothers avenged their father's murder in a blood feud, they had saddled their camels and gone out to the Jabal to dig for savak, a soft soil they used to fertilize their crops. Digging around a massive boulder, they hit a red earthenware jar almost a meter high. Muhammad Ali hesitated to break the jar, considering that a jinn, or a spirit, might live inside. But realizing that it might also contain gold, he raised his mattock and smashed the jar. So greed won out, right? And discovered inside 13 papyrus books bound in leather. Returning to his home in Alcazar, Muhammad Ali dumped the books and loose papyrus leaves on the straw piled on the ground next to the oven. Muhammad's mother, Ahmad, admits that she burned much of the papyrus in the oven along with the straw she used to kindle the fire. A few weeks later, as Muhammad Ali tells it, he and his brothers avenged their father's death by murdering Amma Ismail. Their mother had warned her sons to keep their mattock sharp. When they learned that their father's enemy was nearby, the brothers seized the opportunity, hacked off his limbs, ripped out his heart, and devoured it among them as the ultimate act of blood revenge. Fearing that the police investigating the murder would search his house and discover the books, Muhammad Ali asked the priest, Al-Kumus Basilius Abd al-Masi, now see if I can pronounce that right, to keep one or more for him. During the time that Muhammad Ali and his brothers were being interrogated for murder, Raghib, a local history teacher, had seen one of the books and suspected that it had value. Having received one from Al-Kumus Basilius, Raghib sent it to a friend in Cairo to find out its worth. Sold on the black market through antiquities dealers in Cairo, the manuscript soon attracted the attention of officials of the Egyptian government. Through circumstances of high drama, as we shall see, they bought one and confiscated 10.5 of the 13 leather-bound books called codices and deposited them in the Coptic Museum in Cairo. But a large part of the 13th codex, containing 5 extraordinary texts, was smuggled out of Egypt and offered for sale in America. Word of this codex soon reached Professor Gilles Quispel, distinguished historian of religion in Utrecht in the Netherlands. Excited by the discovery, Quispel urged the Jung Foundation in Zurich to buy the codex, but discovering when he succeeded that some of the pages were missing, he flew to Egypt in the spring of 1955 to try to find them in the Coptic Museum. Arriving in Cairo, he went at once to the Coptic Museum, borrowed photographs of some of the text, and hurried back to his hotel to decipher them. Tracing out the first line, Quispel was startled, then incredulous to read, "These are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke, and which the twin, Judas Thomas, wrote down." Quispel knew that his colleague, H.C. Puch, using notes from another French scholar, Jean Dores, had identified the opening lines with fragments of a Greek Gospel of Thomas discovered in the 1890s. But the discovery of the whole text raised new questions. Did Jesus have a twin brother, as this text implies? Could the text be authentic, an authentic record of Jesus' sayings? According to its title, it contained the Gospel according to Thomas. Yet unlike the Gospels of the New Testament, this text identified itself as a secret Gospel. Quispel also discovered that it contained many sayings known from the New Testament, but these sayings, placed in unfamiliar contexts, suggested other dimensions of meaning. Other passages, Quispel found, differed entirely from any known Christian tradition. The living Jesus, for example, speaks in sayings as cryptic and compelling as Zen koans. Jesus said, "If you bring forth what is within you, what you will bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you." What Quispel held in his hand, the Gospel of Thomas, was only one of the 52 texts discovered at Nag Hammadi. Bound into the same volume with it was the Gospel of Philip, which attributes to Jesus acts and sayings quite different from those in the New Testament. Here's one of them. "The companion of the Savior is Mary Magdalene, but Christ loved her more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth. The rest of the disciples were offended, and they said to him, 'Why do you love her more than all of us?' The Savior answered to them, 'Why do I not love you as I love her?'" Other sayings in this collection criticize common Christian belief, such as the virgin birth or the bodily resurrection, as naive misunderstandings. Bound together with these Gospels is the Apocryphon, literally the secret book of John, which opens with an offer to reveal the mysteries and the things hidden in silence, which Jesus taught to his disciple John. Muhammad Ali later admitted that some of the texts were lost, burned up, or thrown away, but what remains is astonishing. Some 52 texts from the early centuries of the Christian era, including a collection of the early Christian Gospels previously unknown. Besides the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip, the find included the Gospel of Truth, the Gospel to the Egyptians, which identifies itself as the sacred book of the great invisible spirit. Another group of texts consists of writings attributed to Jesus' followers, such as the secret book of James, the Apocalypse of Paul, the letter of Peter to Philip, and the Apocalypse of Peter. So, given that, you want to start with those and get move backward to the Old Testament, or you want to start with an Old Testament and move forward to the New, which would be the normal thing we would do? Anybody have a preference? Yeah? Huh? It's all good. It's all good. Okay, what I had intended to do, let's just do that. We'll work our way back. I want to start with the Apocrypha, which is canonical to two-thirds of Christianity, remember? Roman Catholics and an Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, but not to Protestants. And I just want to read a few. This is actually not a Roman Catholic Bible. This is a New American Standard, revised RSV Bible, but includes the Apocrypha. And I wanted to read a little bit from the Wisdom of Solomon. And this is a book that's attributed to Solomon. Of course, was written much later in time. It's part of that group of books that were included in the Septuagint, but then later deleted by the reformers in the 16th century. But I just want to read a couple passages. To me, this is one of the most beautiful books. I remember I attended a Catholic funeral, and I was asked to read one of the passages in the ritual of the Mass for that funeral, and this was the passage that I was asked to read, and it's just always stuck in my mind as being so amazing. But the souls of the righteous are in the hand of God, and no torment will ever touch them. In the eyes of the foolish they seem to have died, and their departure was thought to be an affliction, and their going from us to be their destruction, but they are at peace. For though in the sight of men they were punished, their hope is full of immortality. Having been disciplined a little, they will receive great good, because God tested them and found them worthy of himself. Like gold in the furnace, he tried them. Like a sacrificial burnt offering, he accepted them. In the time of their visitation, they will shine forth and will run like sparks through the stubble. They will govern nations and rule over peoples, and the Lord will reign over them forever. Those who trust in him will understand truth, and the faithful will abide with them in love, because grace and mercy are upon his elect, and he watches over his holy ones. Just love that. And this one, 8 to 14, just listen to the poetry here. What has our arrogance profited us, and what good has our boasted wealth brought us? All those things have vanished like a shadow, and like a rumor that passes by. Like a ship that sails through the billowy water, and when it is passed, no trace can be found, nor track of its keel in the waves. Or as when a bird flies through the air, no evidence of its passage is found. The light air, lashed by the beat of its pinions, and pierced by the force of its rushing flight, is traversed by the movement of its wings, and afterward, no sign of its coming is found there. Whereas when an arrow is shot at a target, the air thus divided comes together again at once, so that no one knows its pathway. So we also, as soon as we were born, ceased to be, and we had no sign of virtue to show, but were consumed in our wickedness. Because the hope of the ungodly man is like chaff carried by the wind, and like a light hoarfrost driven away by a storm, it is dispersed like smoke before the wind, and it passes like the remembrance of a guest who stays but a day. That contrasted with, but the righteous live forever, and the reward is with the Lord, the Most High takes care of them, and so on and so forth. So you see that contrast. I just, Can you just see those pictures? I mean, it's just beautifully written. Love it. Of course, Solomon didn't write it, but it's attributed to him. There are additions to the book of Esther. There are additions to the book of Daniel. And some of these are amazing short stories. I don't know. Susanna's kind of long. I don't think we should read it now. I mean, when I say long, it's 3 pages. But it reads like a modern short story. It's marvelous in its character description and the plot and the way that it moves. It's a perfect, almost like a mystery novel. It's like the classic, you know, good versus evil. Susanna is a beautiful young girl who is married. She's righteous, and because she's so desirable, 3 wicked men try to rape her when she's alone in her garden. And when she won't go through with it and they're discovered, they accuse her of the salacious act. And so the young Daniel, the sagacious one, is the one who is able to, figure out what happened and to prove it. And she is vindicated and so forth. But the way it reads is wonderful. And it's an addition to the book of Daniel. Sometimes it is put at the end of the book. Sometimes it's put actually at the beginning of the book because it speaks of Daniel as a young lad. You know, and so they put it before the actual book. I did want to read a couple of ones that appear after the book of Daniel, and it's Bel and the Dragon. And this will give you a flavor for the kind of writing that occurs here. This is about Bel. When King Astyages was laid with his fathers, Cyrus the Persian received his kingdom, and Daniel was a companion of the king and was the most honored of his friends. Now the Babylonians had an idol called Bel, and every day they spent on it 12 bushels of fine flour, 40 sheep, and 50 gallons of wine. The king revered it and went every day to worship it, but Daniel worshipped his own god. And the king said to him, "Why do you not worship Bel?" He answered, "Because I do not revere man-made idols, but the living God, who created heaven and earth and his dominion over all the flesh." The king said to him, "Do you not think that Bel is a living God? Do you not see how much he eats and drinks every day?" Then Daniel laughed and said, "Do not be deceived, O king, for this is but clay inside and brass outside, and it never ate or drank anything." And then the king was angry, and he called his priests and said to them, "If you don't tell me who is eating these provisions, you shall die. But if you prove that Bel is eating them, then Daniel shall die, because he blasphemed against Bel." And Daniel said to the king, "Let it be done as you have said." Now these were 70 priests of Bel, besides their wives and children. And the king went with Daniel into the temple of Bel. And the priest of Bel said, "Behold, we are going outside. You yourself, O king, shall set forth the food and mix and place the wine, and shut the door and seal it with your signet. And when you return in the morning, if you do not find that Bel has eaten it all, we will die, or else Daniel will, who is telling lies about us." They were unconcerned, for beneath the table they had made a hidden entrance through which they used to go in regularly and consume all of the provisions. When the king had gone out, and the king set forth the food for Bel, then Daniel ordered his servants to bring ashes, and they sifted them through the whole temple in the presence of the king alone. Then they went out, shut the door, and sealed it with the king's signet, and departed. In the night the priests came with their wives and children, as they were accustomed to do, and ate and drank everything. Early in the morning the king rose and came, and Daniel with him. And the king said, "Are the seals unbroken, Daniel?" And he answered, "They are unbroken, O king." As soon as the doors were open, the king looked at the table and shouted in a loud voice, "You are great, O Bel, and with you there is no deceit, none at all." Then Daniel laughed and restrained the king from going in and said, "Look at the floor and notice whose footsteps these are." The king said, "I see the footsteps of men and women and children." Then the king was enraged, and he seized the priests and their wives and children, and they showed him the secret doors through which they were accustomed to enter and devour what was on the table. Therefore the king put them to death and gave Bel over to Daniel, who destroyed it and its temple. This is obviously making fun of idols and showing the silliness of worshiping them. But this other one is also interesting. There was also a great dragon with that the Babylonians revered. And the king said to David, "You cannot deny that this is a living God, so worship him." And Daniel said, "I will worship the Lord my God, for he is the living God. But if you, O king, will give me permission, I will slay the dragon without sword or club." And the king said, "I give you permission." Then Daniel took pitch, fat, and hair and boiled them together and made cakes, which he fed to the dragon. The dragon ate them and burst open. And Daniel said, "See what you have been worshiping?" And it goes on from there and tells more part of the tale. But again, a similar story. But in that vein, with that kind of narrative style, Susanna also is written. And they're wonderful stories. Should they be canonical? No, I don't know. Catholics think so.
I think that Solomon should.
Wisdom of Solomon. I know, it's so wonderful, isn't it? I wanted to read you one section from 2 Maccabees because this is really interesting. Listen to this. On the next day, and Maccabees is a historical book. It's a story of the Maccabean revolt that occurred in the 2nd century B.C. But this section is important, especially to the Catholic Church, and you'll see why as I go forth. On the next day, as by that time it had become necessary, Judas, that would be Judas Maccabeus, and his men went to take the bodies of the fallen and to bring them back to lie with their kinsmen in the sepulchres of their fathers. Then under the tunic of every one of the dead they found the sacred tokens of the idols of Jamnia, which the law forbids the Jews to wear. And it became clear to all that this is why these men had fallen. So they all blessed the ways of the Lord, the righteous judge, who reveals the things that are hidden. And they turned to prayer, beseeching that the sin which had been committed might be wholly blotted out. And the noble Judas exhorted the people to keep themselves from sin, for they had seen with their own eyes what had happened because of the sin of those who had fallen. He also took up a collection, man by man, to the amount of 2,000 drachmas of silver, and sent it to Jerusalem to provide for a sin offering. In doing this he acted very well and honorably, taking account of the resurrection. For if he were not expecting that those who had fallen would rise again, it would have been superfluous and foolish to pray for the dead. But if he was looking to the splendid reward that is laid up for those who fall asleep in godliness, it was a holy and pious thought. Therefore he made atonement for the dead, that they might be delivered from their sin. Now just in hearing that, do you see why it would be important to the Catholic Church and their teaching? This is the basis of the idea of purgatory. This is the basis of the idea of praying for the dead. This is the basis for the idea of the money offerings to help the dead get out of purgatory faster. That sparked the actual indulgences. Thank you. Couldn't think of the word. All of that is based in this scripture, and so this was another reason that the Protestant reformers were so unwilling to use the Latin text, because they contained either shades of meaning or they contained books that were the basis for part of the Christian theology or the Christian dogma that they were trying to get out from under, but has its basis here in Maccabees. Yeah.
Martin Luther...
Yeah, Luther was one of them, certainly, yeah.
Why did he pull Maccabees?
Because, remember, the books of the Apocrypha are books that were included in the Septuagint, the Greek 3rd century BC translation from the Hebrew, but they were not included in the Hebrew Bible. The Jews threw them out in the 1st century during that time at Yavne, in that council. So they threw them out because they couldn't find a Hebrew original. And so they continued on with their tradition without those books. But all the Christian Bibles were based on the Septuagint, so they had included them. And so the Catholic tradition and the Vulgate and the Latin Bibles of by medieval times and then into the Reformation era included it. But when they were splitting from Rome, they went back to the source. So they kind of en-ran, 1,500 years of Western tradition, went right back to the Hebrew source. And since they weren't there, they went with that canon rather than the other. So they ended up excluding them. Does that make sense?
It does, but it's not
to
agree.
Ooh!
This is not right.
Well, then you need to get one of these Bibles. I think, though, when you read something like Bell and the Dragon or Susanna, and especially if you read some of the other ones that we haven't read from... There is sort of a qualitative difference in some of these, and you can feel it. It's got a different feel. and there are additions to Esther as well and some of the others. And I have read through enough of them. I can't say I've read everything, but I read through enough to realize that there's nothing we're missing in any of those texts. You know, either they reinforce, and sometimes beautifully so, like in the Wisdom of Solomon, which I really love that book. But there's nothing new. There's nothing different. You know, I think the church fathers in choosing the canon did a pretty good job, you know. And some of them you can tell why they're not there.
It does present a really good challenge, though. My sister is a foaming at the mouth Catholic, and in my ignorance, up to this moment, 90 seconds ago, I would have said, purgatory is not in the Bible. Well, guess what? It's in her Bible. So how do you argue that point? I mean, wow, it's in her Bible.
And it's not, you know, obviously the word purgatory isn't in there, the concept of praying for the dead, that the dead can be moved along the path after death by the prayers of the living, which of course is exactly what the Mormons do. I mean, the whole reason for the genealogies of the Mormons is to find out who all your relatives were that weren't good enough Mormons so that you can pray for them. So that tradition of praying for the dead is part of Mormon belief and theology as well. You know? Yeah.
And those didn't have original Hebrew manuscripts to support.
There were none in existence by the time.
And when did those extra books in the Catholic Bible were written around the same time as the Bible, but they were just...
They would have been written in that time of so-called silence. In the intertestament times. So most of them were written probably in the second, third centuries BC, maybe first century BC, so in that time.
And they were included when?
I'm sorry?
When were they included?
Well, they were part of the cloud of Jewish literature of the time. In Alexandria and Egypt, a group of Jewish scholars who were Hellenized, they spoke Greek, they translated the Hebrew scriptures into Greek, including all those books of the Apocrypha. Okay. By the time you go forward another 300-400 years and the rabbis are reinventing Judaism, the Hebrew originals were lost. And all that was left was the Greek translation. And so they said, okay, if we can't find Hebrew originals, and remember, by this time, Jewish followers and Gentile followers of Jesus are using the Septuagint and considering those books canonical, there is a reason to separate that as well and have a distinctive Jewish canon as opposed to the canon that was now also being used by the Christians. And so they, for both reasons, they threw out the Apocrypha because they couldn't find the Hebrew original and they wanted to distinguish themselves from this growing Christian movement. So that's when they threw them out at the end of the first century, AD, CE. Well, yeah, since they didn't have a Hebrew original for those books, yeah, they found them. That would have been the Pharisees, yeah. The last surviving group after the fall of Jerusalem.
And who was the group? What was the name of the group that kept them?
The group that kept the books? Oh, well, it was in the Septuagint. It was in that Greek translation. But the Christians by then were accepting the Septuagint, and so they were using that as the basis of their Old Testament.
Oh, I'm with you now.
See? Yeah. And especially as Christianity was moving further and further into Gentile areas, Greek-speaking areas, they were using that Septuagint was their Old Testament. You know.
The dragon was from Dallas.
That explains it all. Thanks for clearing that up, huh?
Let's just read a couple more. Oh, I'm sorry, Peter, do you have your hand up?
I just wanted to ask how the Dead Sea Scrolls do it. Do they have pieces of that?
I'm sorry?
The Dead Sea Scrolls have pieces of about the
photos. I believe they do. I'm not sure how many they actually do, but they're fragments.
Of course, the idea that the Catholics run the right track to that.
You know, I'd have to look and see if there is an actual large representation of apocryphal books. There's every book of the canonical Old Testament except Esther, but as far as apocryphal books, I'd have to look that one up and see. No, I don't know if the Catholics can get a whole lot of comfort from the Dead Sea Scrolls. I know we don't have too much time left. I wanted to read a couple of passages from the Genesis Apocryphon, which would be like the secret book of Genesis. And this book was found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, and it deals with familiar characters from Genesis that we're familiar with, but in completely different ways. And some of these are really colorful, really interesting. This one deals with the birth of Noah, and it's actually dealing with his father Lamech and his mother Bathanosh. But just take a listen. Behold, I thought then within my heart, this is Lamech speaking, the father of Noah, that conception was due to the watchers and the holy ones and to the giants, and my heart was troubled within me because of this child. Then I, Lamech, approached Bathanoth, my wife, in haste and said to her, by the Most High, the great Lord, the King of all the worlds and ruler of the sons of heaven, tell me truthfully and not falsely, is the seed within you mine? Okay, now do you remember the story in Genesis where the watchers, the sons of God, come down to earth and they mate with the daughters of men? Remember that story? And so basically the tradition is that some form of angel, they were called watchers, came down to earth and actually mated with human females, and they produced a race of Nephilim, which were giants among the land who were, you know, always up to no good, chronically up to no good. So Lamech is afraid that his wife was actually impregnated by one of these watchers and not by him, and that's he's confronting her about this. Then Bathanosh, my wife, spoke to me with much heat, as you can imagine, and said, O my brother, O my Lord, remember my pleasure, the lying together, and the soul within its body, and I tell you all things truthfully. My heart was then greatly troubled within me, and when Bathanosh, my wife, saw my countenance had changed, then she mastered her anger and spoke to me, saying, O my Lord, O my brother, remember my pleasure. I swear to you by the Holy Great One, the King of the heavens, that this seed is yours, and that this conception is from you. This fruit was planted by you, and by no stranger or watcher or son of heaven. Why is your countenance thus changed and dismayed, and why is your spirit thus distressed? I speak to you truthfully. Isn't that interesting? I mean, you can feel the, isn't that what any wife would say? And it's just amazing to me how human this is, how understandable. Then I, Lamech, ran to Methuselah, my father, and I told him all these things, and I asked him to go to Enoch, his father, for he would surely learn all things from him, for he was beloved. And he shared the lot of the angels. Remember, Enoch was the one who did not die. He was translated, and he was thought in Jewish lore to reside in Parvain, which was paradise. When Jesus says, "To this day you will be with me in paradise," to the good thief on the cross, that idea of paradise was where they thought Enoch was, that he was taken by God to live there. So he's sending his father Methuselah to intercede for him to ask Enoch for the truth, because he doesn't trust his wife. So he, Methuselah, went at once to Parvain, and he found him there, and he said to Enoch his father, O my father, my lord, I say to you, lest you be angry with me because I come here. And then there's a big lacuna, a big break, and we don't get any more of the story. Bummer, huh? Tune in next life. But I just want to give you a flavor of some of these stories that they wrap around the biblical stories, but they give lots more information. And here the next one I want is the same thing. This one deals with Abraham He would be the Abram at the time. And remember when Abram goes to Egypt with Sarai and his whole train, his whole entourage, but he's afraid because Sarai is so beautiful that he's going to be killed because they're going to want his wife, and he talks her into saying that he's his brother. Well, this gives a lot. This is, as What's-His-Face used to say, was the rest of the story. Who was that guy? Paul Harvey, and he just died, didn't he? He was so interesting. And during the night, let me move back a paragraph. And on the night of our entry into Egypt, I, Abram, dreamt a dream, and behold, I saw in my dream a cedar tree and a palm tree. Men came, and they sought to cut down the cedar tree and to pull up its roots, leaving the palm tree standing alone. But the palm tree cried out, saying, "Do not cut down this cedar tree, for cursed be he who shall fell it." And the cedar tree was spared because of the palm tree and was not felled. And you're getting the deal, the cedar tree, and she's the palm tree. And during the night I woke from my dream, and I said to Sarai, my wife, "I have dreamt a dream, and I am fearful because of the dream." She said to me, "Tell me your dream that I may know it." So I began to tell her this dream and told her the interpretations of the dream, that they will seek to kill me, but will spare you. Say to them, "He is my brother. Because of you I shall live, and because of you my life shall be saved." And Sarai wept that night on account of my words. Then we journeyed towards Zoan, I and Sarai. And when those 5 years had passed, three men from among the princes of Egypt came at the command of the Pharaoh of Zoan to inquire after my business and after my wife, and they gave goodness, wisdom, and truth. And I exclaimed before them because of the famine. And they came to ascertain with much food and drink and wine. And during the party, the Egyptians must have seen Sarai, and on their return, they praised her to the king, saying, "How beautiful is her face, how fine are the hairs of her head, how lovely are her eyes, how desirable her nose and all the radiance of her countenance, how fair are her breasts and how beautiful all her whiteness, how pleasing are her arms, how perfect her hands, and how desirable all the appearance of her hands. How fair are her palms, and how long and slender are her fingers. How comely are her feet, how perfect her thighs." "No virgin or bride led into the marriage chamber is more beautiful than she. She is fairer than all the other women. Truly her beauty is greater than theirs. Yet together with all this grace, she possesses abundant wisdom, so that whatever she does is perfect." Very reminiscent of the Song of Songs, right? The Song of Solomon, that same kind of imagery, but certainly detail we didn't get in Genesis, right? You know, Genesis says she was beautiful, or she was, yeah, that's all you get. Here you get a whole paragraph. Is this? Not that I know of, no. And then it goes on. You know, when the king heard the words of Harkonosh and the two companions, and it kind of follows the story from there. But much of these stories, again, remember what I was telling you at the beginning? They are taking these original texts that are so spare, so sparse, you know, and they're living them. They want to know more, and they're embellishing them and writing, you know, beyond them. And we do the same thing, don't we? You know, we take stories that we know and we embellish them and we imagine them and you know, blow them out full. And so it's just amazing to see that happening also with the scriptures. Let's see, a couple more and we'll... This one is, moving now to the New Testament. And this is part of the Acts of John. A lot of these book of Acts of these various followers of Jesus and other characters in the New Testament are basically just like what we would call signs gospels. It's just things that the apostles have done, and some of them are amazing and fantastic, and then others are more mundane. This one is one of the funny ones that I thought would just be fun to read. It's called the Obedient Bugs, and this will be John. The apostle of Jesus. But it's just a story. On the first day, we arrived at a lonely inn, and while we were trying to find a bed for John, we saw a curious thing. There was one bed there lying somewhere not made up. So we spread the cloaks which we were wearing over it and begged him to lie down on it and take his ease, while all the rest of us slept on the floor. But when he lay down, he was troubled by the bugs, as they became more and more troublesome to him. And it was already midnight, and he said to them in the hearing of us all, "I tell you, you bugs, to behave yourselves, one and all, You must leave your home for tonight and be quiet in one place and keep your distance from the servants of God. And while we laughed and went on talking, John went to sleep, but we talked quietly, and thanks to him, we were not disturbed. Now, as the day was breaking, I got up first, and Venus and Andronicus, Varus and Andronicus, with me. And we saw by the door of the room which we had taken, a mass of bugs collected. And as we were astounded at the great number of them, and all the brethren had woken up because of them, John went on sleeping. And when he woke up, we explained to him what we had seen. And he sat up in bed and looked at them and said, "Since you have behaved yourselves and listened to my correction, go back to your own place." And when he had said this and had got up from the bed, the bugs came running from the door towards the bed and climbed up its legs and disappeared into the joints. Then John said again, "This creature listened to a man's voice and kept to itself and was quiet and obedient. But we who hear the voice of God disobey his commandments and are irresponsible. How long will this go on?" Wonderful story. And there's just dozens of these stories, little pericopes, little snippets of stories about the various followers. I'm sorry? A pericope. It's a little snippet of a story. Don't let the bed bugs bite. Yes. Okay, it's 9:10. What we'll do, starting with our next session, we'll get into the Gnostic scriptures. This is really the meat. Reading through the Gospel of Thomas. I want to take some time with that and read through some of the sayings. It's fascinating to see the parallels to the canonical text and the real contrast to the canonical text. We'll also read from the Gospel of Mary, which also is fascinating itself, and the story that she tells about the ascent of the soul, and then you start to see the real headbutting between Mary and Peter. Traditionally, Peter was always hard on women, and he was always a hothead, right? In every scene that you see Peter, whether it's canonical or non-canonical, Peter must have had such a distinctive personality that it always got into whatever text anyone was writing about, because he's always impetuous, always a hothead, and he spars with Mary quite a bit. So you're going to see that in some of these. And then we're going to read from the infancy narratives, and if you think the bedbugs was an interesting story, wait till you read how some of these second century people imagined Jesus to be as a young child with all his powers intact, and what he did with those powers. It's fascinating. So we'll start there, and then we'll move forward. And I'm sorry we didn't get to this tonight, but it's getting late. So, who would like to close us in prayer? Anybody feeling the need for speed? Okay, Daryl, you go, buddy.